I think it's started. We do not have a quorum yet, but once we do, we're going to interrupt our proceedings to get ourselves up to speed on everything. And we're going to start off with Representative Rumbeck. And now we have quorum. I'm going to officially call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packet, you have the minutes from March 14, 2017. Representative Flanagan, you want to move those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Flanagan moves the minutes for March 14th. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. Members, we're going to start with House File 1160. I'm going to move House File 1160 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. And Representative Rumbeck, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Committee. 1160 is a bill that seeks more oversight of the transit financial activity of the Met Council. And in saying that, we're including the Joint Powers Board called the County's Transit Improvement Board. And frankly, this could extend even to other areas that have gotten involved in the building of transit, which would be, for example, the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, where there are some questions that have arisen about conflict of interest. But this is requiring the Office of the Legislative Auditor to conduct an operational review, a performance review, really to see in the course of things if we are getting what we expected out of this process. We're at a point in time where CTIB is desiring to dissolve, perhaps, although that is still somewhat up in the air. So we're sort of at a juncture where these kinds of questions are going to, I think, need to be answered, and it would be a tremendous service to the legislature. Certainly the OLA, I believe, is the right organization to conduct this audit. They are the legislative branch kind of authority on these matters. Yes, audits are currently conducted by the state auditor on Met Council, but that's a financial audit. That's a very, very limited, sort of narrow-scoped review of their financial activity. So this would be a much broader look-see to answer questions like, well, how are the funds transferred? What happens with these obligations that CTIP has made, the contracts that have been signed? Where will the cost overruns fall? Who will be responsible for those, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Currently, CTIB is building two light rail lines simultaneously, so they are very busy trying to reach a point in their construction where it's very hard to go backwards. So it's an important and crucial time, I think, in their history. When CTIB was created in 2008, it was created as a duplicative entity to the Met Council. They are not overseen by the Met Council. They operate quite autonomously. People I've spoken to say that the meetings aren't recorded, you don't have minutes for the meetings, etc. I think there's just a lot of questions that bring to mind the need for this, and that is really what the bill does, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do you have any testifiers, Representative Rumbeck?
Well, I've been in consultation with the OLA's office.
Okay.
They have actually already requested a lot of the data. They feel very, capable of handling this. And they've received many requests over the years to take a look at Met Council, to take a look at CTIB. And in some ways, they perhaps would have done this anyway. So it's within their jurisdiction to say, this would be something we do feel we need to look at. But they, I'm sure, would be willing to speak to the committee.
Mr. Nobles, I see you in the audience. Would you care to comment? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Jim Nobles, legislative auditor. Madam Chair, just a brief comment. Just to remind everyone that the jurisdiction and responsibility of the legislative auditor and the state auditor is a matter of state law. It is established by the legislature. You originally made that division of responsibility in 1973 when you gave the state auditor jurisdiction over local government, the state auditor jurisdiction over state government. And then over time, you had to decide who had jurisdiction over the metropolitan agencies, because they fell somewhere in between. And so you made that adjustment, as you've made many other adjustments over the years. And currently, the legislative auditor has clear audit jurisdiction over the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, what used to be the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. Currently, the state auditor, as was just mentioned, has jurisdiction over the Metropolitan Council. So, again, I guess my basic point to you is, as you have done in the past, you certainly have the prerogative and the constitutional right, I believe, to establish whatever parameters and jurisdictions you want to establish over these various organizations, CTIB, the Metropolitan Council. We think that if that's what you want, then Representative Runbeck's bill is one that you should enact, because I think it would be more clear that we have ongoing underlying jurisdiction to do audits and special reviews over the Metropolitan Council and organizations like CTIB. We have done evaluations of the Metropolitan Council of various other regional metropolitan transit issues, but those were all authorized under the Legislative Audit Commission. So if you want to be able to come to the legislative auditor and request a special review, I think you should provide that underlying jurisdiction in state law. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. And before we get to questions for you, Mr. Nobles, I would like, Ms. Roberts, if you want to go through the fiscal note that we have, too.
Madam Chair, members, you do have a fiscal note in front of you that was prepared by the Legislative Auditor's Office, and you'll see on the front page there's a cost of $130,000 in fiscal year 17. But to be clear, I think if you look on page 5 of the fiscal note, which talks about the assumptions that were used, that $130,000 appropriation is intended to be a one-time appropriation that would actually cover 9 reviews over 3 fiscal years, one in fiscal year 17 and then 4 quarterly reviews in fiscal year 2018 and 2019. And the OLA is assuming that they would assign the duties of an experienced auditor, and it would take approximately half of that auditor's time. So that is a total annual cost of $57,956, and then it's calculated for those 9 reviews.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Members, any questions for Mr. Nobles? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Mr. Nobles, to the committee. A couple of questions. Can you address a little bit about whether we're duplicating work being done by the state auditor? How does that work? And I know the public gets confused by the two different jobs of Office of Legislative Auditor and the state auditor. Maybe you could say a little bit about the duplication aspect, and then I had a follow-up question.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Johnson, I would not intend to duplicate any of the work that the state auditor does. This is the annual financial statement audit that the state auditor audits of the Metropolitan Council. I would not intend to duplicate that work at all. I think the purpose here is to give the legislative auditor that underlying statutory authority again, so that if you or any member of the legislature had some specific concern about a particular activity at the Metropolitan Council, I would be able to respond to that. But I would not in any way want to duplicate what the state auditor already does. This does, in addition to the Metropolitan Council, add this on one time, sort of over several months' time, give us jurisdiction and responsibility to do financial reviews of CTIB, which Representative Runbeck just indicated is in the process of dissolving. And so this would be a one-time responsibility to do financial analysis of that disillusionment. As you know from today's news, there is starting to be some controversy related to the distribution of the money back to the several counties that are members. So I assume if this were to pass, we would be involved in that dispute in terms of financial analysis.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just a comment, Representative Runbeck. I'm sensitive to directing more work by our state employees without providing the funding to get that done. So I hope if this bill moves forward, if the chair seems fit to add it to an omnibus bill, for example, that you fight for the funding necessary to give the office the bodies to get the work done. So that's my only other comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify to this bill?
Madam Chair, if I could just respond briefly to the point about an appropriation. We did not ask for additional money or positions to take on any additional work for related to the Metropolitan Council. As I said, we don't intend to duplicate, and I think it will be on a special review basis. And we have responsibility to prioritize our work all the time. We have jurisdiction over 160 different organizations. We don't audit them every year. So we would apply to this new responsibility the same that we do for all the other responsibility. We would use our strategy and prioritization process to be responsive to legislative concerns.
Okay. Madam Auditor. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. Thank you, Madam Chair and members and Representative Runbeck. So for efficiency's sake and for saving taxpayer dollars, you know, we already audit these entities. We also audit the County Transit Improvement Board. And so I want the legislature to know that the state auditor also provides us work to the legislature. It's, you know, for your benefit as well. And if anybody wants any of this information, it's already there. So. And if there is a legal compliance concern, that you certainly can report that to our office if that's something you want us to follow up on, because we also make sure they're complying with the laws. So there's already a provision in place, and if there's something that's really gone wrong, you can contact us and we can have an investigation done. But we have the authority. We do the work. We know where everything is. And so, and I do know the Legislative Audit Commission chooses which special studies are done, and so they have the authority to decide that. As he said, they can decide that, you know, a special review needs to be done of one of these entities. But we are certainly here. The work has been done, and there's a cost for having additional work done to all of the entities involved. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, any questions for Madam Auditor at all? Representative Funesh-Podine.
Thank you. Just so that I'm clear on this, if you are already doing all of those things, why is it necessary to have another entity do it? I don't quite understand why. I don't quite understand why you have to duplicate that. Are certain agencies not able to access your information? Or no, I guess I don't quite understand that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Runbeck.
There's a difference. This bill is asking for more of an operational performance review, which is typically what the OLA does. They are not necessarily always doing financial reviews, so there's several different kinds, and we're looking for a broader look at how these entities all work together and how the funds transfer and what the documents they're relying on say and so on and so forth. So it's a much deeper type of audit.
Representative Kanesh-Podine.
So would the auditor's office be able to do that more in-depth research or reporting? I mean, are there limits that office isn't able to do that another whole agency or program has to do it?
Madam Chair and Representative, what the Office of the Legislative Auditor does is performance reviews. So if you've seen some of their studies, you get, you know, incredible analysis of key findings and key recommendations. You know, how are these agencies operating? You know, what are some things that they might not be attending to well enough? What are some areas where they could be more efficient? I mean, you know, it's a different kind of a look at an agency.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to State Auditor, I'm curious, and I apologize, I haven't read the audit, but the other day in Ways and Means, I had a question relative to ridership and the information that was presented to us. I think I came up with something like there was supposed to be 50 or 60 people on every train every day relative to what was being reported. Is something like that covered in your audit where you go in and verify the information that's being given to the legislature so that we're making decisions on that, or is it just financial in nature? And I apologize again, I haven't read it.
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair and Representative Vogel, we do some agreed-upon procedure reports as well. So we have one on Metro Mobility. We have one on Metropolitan Transportation Services. We have one on Metro Transit. And so if you would like a copy of these reports, I'm really happy to send them to you. And if you have further questions, we would be happy to get back to you on that.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would appreciate that. And one of the reasons I bring this up is a matter of perspective. I recognize that you might have your agreed-upon procedures or your standard things that you do, but the legislature itself, as being the enabling body on a lot of this stuff, may have other questions that want to be put to the into an audit. And I'm just curious how those are addressed. If you've come to the legislature and asked for the perspective of what the legislators would want to see, or if it's just typically an agreed-upon procedure with the client, in this case Metro Transit or CTIP or whoever.
Madam Auditor.
That's a good question, and we can talk to you offline about that. I mean, we normally do financial statement audits. The bill that you're looking at today is putting Metropolitan Council into the Financial Audit Division of Legislative Auditor, which normally does financial statement audits. That's why I came to the table. We already conduct the financial statement audits. It's a performance audit. That's their other division. And so if anyone's reading that law, it's being put into the Financial Audit Division, which does financial statement audits, which is what we do. And but I can get these to you, and we have done special studies before if we have staff to do that, and we've looked at something around, it was bonding within districts for, was it pension liabilities? We've done some special studies over time again, so if there was something you were really interested in, it's possible. There is a lot of work that's done. Metropolitan Council is a large entity, and I know sometimes there's frustration with legislators or communities as they, you know, work together or don't always agree on things. But if you let us know what your questions are, we will certainly try to get back to you with whatever we have.
Just one more follow-up. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess just getting back to that matter of perspective, so basically if the legislature came to you and said, in the case of my question, which I realize is a simple question, but I, you know, it just doesn't seem like whatever the number I came up with was realistic. If they came to you, then that would be a separate agreed-upon procedure to add to the audit, and I suppose it would take extra staff or something, or how would that go?
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, probably not an agreed-upon procedures engagement. That's a limited engagement agreed upon with the entity. Sometimes it's reviewing federal programs or what their internal controls are. But again, if you want to get back to me on exactly what your questions are, I'm certainly happy to see if we have information for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Nash?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Auditor, a couple of questions for you. So on the audit that you've done for the Metropolitan Council, percentage-wise of the total amount of time that you allocated for that, what of your yearly bandwidth, what percentage, and you can round up and down, but how much time does that take you roughly?
No idea.
Madam Auditor.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd have to get back to you, Representative Nash.
Okay.
Representative Nash?
Yeah, Madam Auditor, in some of the things that you've looked at, did you participate in an audit of, like, the farebox collection discrepancies that we saw with some of the various lines on some of the light rail? Was that part of your purview?
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, that would not be part of a financial statement audit necessarily. What we're doing is we're opining on whether the financial statements are fairly stated. In agreed-upon procedures, I think your fare box issue is an operational question, and I'm not sure that our audits would cover that.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, and then lastly, Madam Auditor, we've talked about this a lot, and would you agree that the legislature has the purview to change directions on things because we created the various offices and have enabled the various offices, but that we have the ability to do so?
Madam Auditor.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I was a state legislator as well, so normally this is a budget year, so you'll review appropriations and make decisions around that and taxation. You're in the House. You make decisions on policy. Senate does the same thing, and then the governor decides.
Representative Nash.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just infer that you agree that we do have the purview to change things as we see fit. So thank you.
Madam Auditor, on the piece of the legislation, it talks about the financial solvency of anticipated transit projects. Mm-hmm. So is that part of your financial review as well? Or do you comment on the actual fiscal financial solvency of these transit projects going into the future at all?
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm used to you giving me permission.
Yep.
You know, the state gets rating agencies look at the state and their fiscal activities and whether they're being responsible, and so it can impact our bond ratings. Entities or local governments across the state are responsible, governing bodies are responsible for, you know, to the taxpayers and to have good fiscal management. And if they don't, their bond ratings can be knocked down as well. So there are other entities out there that are looking at that. So if we were to try to go in and micromanage every single entity, that would be it would not be a good use of time. Minnesota generally trusts local elected officials in terms of doing their jobs. Metropolitan Council happens to be appointees by the governor, and so it flows back up to the governor. He's elected, and if people aren't happy, they can unelect him. But if you're looking at financial solvency, I can provide you with the financial statement audit if you'd like to look at that and all these other documents. And I think there might be something in here as well in terms of their activities. But the financial statements are in government with government accounting is it's the reason why it exists and there's government auditing standards is that the people need to know what their government has committed to, and that's what the financial statements are. Unfortunately, they tend to be very complicated now. They've gotten so complicated a lot of people don't understand them that well. But that's what these are for. There's transparency. The auditors opine on the financial statements to say that they're fairly stated. That's exactly what this is, although I don't know that a lot of people go into them anymore because they are complicated.
Oh, well, Madam Auditor, I think what I'm hearing you say is that no. You believe that others, the Met Council themselves, are looking at the solvency, but you in your auditing performing duties, that's not something that you provide review. And if you want to get back to me, that's fine too, if that gives you better thought.
Madam Chair, there is a finding that auditors can provide in an audit that's called going concern. And a going concern finding normally is not a good thing. It means there may be major issues, and I do not know that the Metropolitan Council has received a going concern finding.
Well, I'm guessing that you probably haven't reviewed this, given that there is a lot of change that's happening on this area in particular. There is a question of what's going to happen to CTIB. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that you probably haven't done this. If you want to get back to me on it, that's fine. Representative Runbeck.
And Madam Chair, I mean, I think it's worth noting that the date of the last audit that's available for us to review is December 31st, 2015. And so I think that, you know, you've made the point, too, that there's very complex activity going on right now, and there needs to be a more, timely information.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Madam Auditor.
So that's for calendar year 15. It's a calendar 15-year audit that was issued October 17, 2016.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Auditor. Mr. Shetton, you're up next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. And I just wanted to clarify a couple things related to some questions that were asked earlier. One of them, I believe.
I'm going to just pause you for a second. If there's anybody else that wishes to testify on this bill, if you can bring yourself forward so we're ready to rock and roll. Mr. Shetton.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a question about the Farebox audit. And that audit was done not by the state auditor or the legislative auditor. That was done by the Met Council. We did that ourselves to see where we were as far as our fare box recovery. So that was our own audit. There were a few other questions about whether or not the state auditor or legislative auditor would be looking at different functions of the council. What I just wanted to share with the committee is that the legislature currently has a commission called the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance that has 14 members from the metro area. Four in the majority in the House, four in the minority in the House, or three in the minority, and the same in the Senate. And what they do is look at the overall work budget, capital, and operating budgets of the Council. So some of the information that is being discussed here that isn't necessarily part of a financial audit that the state auditor would do or the legislative auditor would do. What we have currently is this legislative commission that's in place today that the council is prepared to have these conversations with the with that group with. So I just wanted to clarify that there already is that ability to engage with the council on any of these questions that you may have. So that may be a better road to go, because the way we see the bill as it stands is we do see that there is a lot of redundancy between what Representative Rumbeck's bill does and what the state auditor currently does. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those for you. But I just wanted to clarify some of the questions that came up, and I apologize for not signing up earlier, but thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Sure. And Mr. Shetton, it would be safe to say that if the legislature directed the Legislative Audit Commission to come and review the Met Council on this area in particular, would you be opposed to that?
Madam Chair and members, we work with the legislature however the legislature wants to come forward and talk to us. The normal way that we do this is what was mentioned earlier, is that the audit commission will bring forward a program to do that. We did that with the report on transit governance back in 2010 and 2011. There's rumors that we'll be looking at something related to metro mobility here this next year. But as far as the financial reporting that is done, we would see that as a redundancy. If it's looking at some part of the council's programs, then it would be more of a program audit, and I'm not sure that what House File 1160 does is a program audit. It looks more like a financial audit, which is what we already do.
And, Mr. Shetton, if it was limited in scope and it was focused on not the things that are performed by, say, the state auditor, you would not be opposed to that, correct?
Madam Chair and members, we would have to see what it looks like. I can't tell you exactly what the council or the administration's position would be. I think it would just be important to see what the audit would look like. But I think people can learn things from audits, so it's just one of those things that I can't answer today until I see what is being asked. But
in general, you can say that you're not opposed to audits, right?
Madam Chair, members, we're not. By statute, we're required to be audited by the state auditor.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes.
Thank you.
Oh, before I go, any questions for Mr. Shetton? Okay. Mr. Hughes.
Hi, my name is Mark Hughes, member of the committee. Chair Anderson, thank you for this opportunity. I support Linda Runbeck on House File 1160, I believe it is. I do think the Met Council should be given a quarterly audit. We've had a lot of troubles with metro mobility. Let me give you one case in existence. Last July, I was on my way to the Twins game, and I had a driver take me down the wrong way, the one way, on one-way road twice. Not once, twice. And so I don't call that performance. And I want the quarterly performance. I don't think the Met Council has performed well. I don't think First Transit has performed well. Linda Runbeck used to be my representative in my neighborhood and has lived in my neighborhood. And I just want to tell you, we have to look into this stuff. And the Met Council needs to be looked at. We need to introduce a bill for metro mobility, which in turn returns it back to the MTC, which in 1976, when it was started as Project Mobility, was started that way. The Met Council's got to get their hands out of it. You got to do a performance audit, because I couldn't have got killed not once but twice, and that's the honest to God truth. Thanks for this time.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Any questions for Mr. Hughes? All right. And before we get to you, Mr. Nobles, is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Mr. Nobles, so are you going to be doing, are you going to be doing a redundant audit?
Madam Chair, I just want to say again and clarify that we would have no intention of duplicating the financial statement audit that is already done, or doing any other financial statement audit. I would just point out that the legislative auditor has jurisdiction for many organizations, including many metropolitan organizations, and we do not do their financial statement audits. We allow those organizations to hire a CPA firm, frankly, because we do not see a lot of value to the legislature in these reports. As the state auditor said, they're very complicated. They do not present information that is readily accessible either to the public or legislators. And I would also point out that under the statute that is referenced by Representative Runbeck's provision, it does not call for us to do a financial statement audit. In fact, within that provision of law, it says, and I quote, The legislative auditor shall see that all provisions of law respecting the appropriate and economic use of public funds and other resources are complied with, and may, as part of a financial audit, or separately, investigate allegations of noncompliance. So under our financial audit responsibility, where this Representative Runbeck places the Metropolitan Council, we clearly have jurisdiction under that authority not to perform a duplicative financial statement audit, but to determine whether or not economic, whether or not public funds are appropriately and economically being used. So just a matter of clarification, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Representative Runbeck, final words, please.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the chance to hear the bill, and I think it would be a tremendous service to the taxpayer to have all the information and the truth about these organizations.
Great. And I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1160 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Members, we're going to take up House File 1433. This is for informational purposes. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a oldie but goodie. It's come back around a couple times. We all in our districts have, it's been one of those days. We all in our districts have these things that come up from time to time where cities or municipalities say, we need to change this rule. This rule was made and we don't know why it may have gone awry from the intent of the legislature or the legislation that was passed. So what this bill does is it sets up some stop gaps, and so that if there's going to be any changes to industries through the rulemaking process, and if they're going to kick in some thresholds with a statement of economic impact, that it would go to a neutral organization that would review that, and then we could bring it back to the legislature before it goes into full rulemaking effect. This essentially gives us the authority as a legislature back to review these legislative intents and make sure that we are part of that process and not just handing rulemaking off to agencies. And so with that, I believe there's a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair.
And if the testifiers for the bill can come forward, please. I've got Laylee Atihi, Kirk Kadelka, and Steve Ring. If you're here and you had your name just called, please come down to the front. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Who you represent?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laylee Fadahi, and I represent Friends of the Mississippi River, a leading citizen-based organization that works to protect and enhance the Mississippi River and its watershed. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today about our concerns with House File 1433. This bill, both by itself and when looked at in conjunction with the many other rulemaking bills that have been heard this session, is an attempt at something that I've taken to calling deregulation by overregulation. In the past, we've seen bills that seek to speed up and to reduce the requirements of rulemaking so that regulated entities get to an answer faster and with fewer hurdles. This bill, however, takes a very interesting approach to solving this challenge in that it imposes massive, time-consuming, and expensive hurdles that an agency must go through, not only to adopt a rule, but even to just propose a rule. And then it makes it so that even after going through all of those hurdles, the rule still has to be enacted by law. The bill is dense and complex in a way that I think, you know, serves the proponent's goals of obfuscating what the bill in its totality does. And what it does is add multiple layers of and mechanisms for obstructing the ability of agencies to develop and implement rules for protecting our environment and natural resources, our health, and our welfare. And while I think the specifics of the bill deserve attention, we'd be here all day if I went through them one by one. So I'm just going to describe kind of the bottom line of what the bill does from our perspective. The bill gives individual legislative committees unchecked authority to block an agency from adopting or from even holding public hearings for proposed rules. This bill short-circuits the very mechanisms created by the legislature in the Administrative Procedures Act to ensure that there's public transparency and accountability of agency decision-making, including transparency and accountability for proposed actions. It concerns me that this bill could create an incentive for agencies to avoid formally proposing rules and encourage them instead to conduct their deliberations about proposed actions in a manner that's more under the radar and less visible to the public and the legislature in order to avoid triggering some of the provisions in this bill. And I certainly don't mean to imply that our current agency's leadership would do that, but the legislature, in passing the Administrative Procedures Act, clearly saw it in their wisdom to account for the possibility and significance of this to the public trust. The bill also imposes requirements that the economic impacts of proposed rules be assessed, and it goes further. It mandates that that calculation of economic impact include a lengthy list of increasingly more remote and unrelated costs, but then also says that it must exclude even the most direct economic benefits that a proposed rule may propose, which, for example, in the context of the environment, would include things like cleanup and remediation savings, more valuable environmental services, increased property values, growth in tourism and outdoor recreation, et cetera, et cetera. The bill then uses these skewed economic impacts to trigger requirements for additional reviews and approvals that both delay and add millions of dollars of expense to the rulemaking process. If the agency's determination of the cost of the rule isn't high enough to trigger these requirements, the bill also creates mechanisms that guarantee that it can be triggered anyway, but provides no guidelines for when and how such an override would be determined as appropriate. And then those inevitably triggered requirements, they include a review by a 5-person review, peer review panel that's convened by the legislative auditor that's charged with determining the soundness of the proposed rule's scientific, technical, and economic basis. However, there are no qualifications or expertise required for being appointed to such a panel other than a one-sided exclusion of those with even an indirect knowledge of the agency's work. No exclusion on any knowledge or relationship with a regulated entity. And yet this panel is supposed to assess scientific, technical, and economic soundness, all of which are issues that typically we would assume require some expertise. And then finally, the bill provides that a proposed rule requiring such a panel, regardless of, you know, even if it goes through the panel and it is comes out with flying colors, it can't take effect anyway until it's approved and enacted as law by the legislature. So in short, the bill allows for a single legislative committee to make it so that, first, a proposed rule never gets a public hearing, second, that it can't avoid the delay and expense of a biased and non-expert peer review, and then finally, that it can't get enacted except as law by the legislature. What's unclear to me is what the point is of going through all these rulemaking delays and reviews and other things that are created by this bill just to get to the point of having the legislature pass a law. The legislature could just pass the law without spending millions of taxpayer dollars on this process that has no justification. I think perhaps the only part of the bill that clearly demonstrates what this bill is all about is Section 2, which amends the language of the state's regulatory policy statement to make, quote, maximum flexibility for the regulated party the absolute non-comparative condition and goal for agency rulemaking and regulation. So I urge you to take the time to unpack what it is that this bill is doing and ask yourself whether you really think that the best way to deal with reining in the cost and delay of rulemaking is to expand the cost and the delay and force it to collapse under its own weight. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I think what we're going to do is we're going to hear from the two other testifiers, and then if you can stick close in case there's questions for you. Mr. Kudelka, and then after Mr. Kudelka, I have Mr. Ring. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The agencies have worked together to consolidate their concerns, so you only have to hear from one of us, and we can save you guys some time. Overall, we just want to talk a little bit about the current process of rulemaking and how the legislature can be involved and is involved. Rulemaking is given to the executive branch agencies to work out details of overall policy that the legislature sets. The agencies that relied on the expertise on the subject matters that require full-time and specialized knowledge. Some examples include Department of Labor and Industry with their workplace safety standards, Department of Human Services with their mental health facilities, Department of Ag with meat inspections, and health with drinking water standards. The legislature also has multiple ways to be involved with it rulemaking already and provide oversight. Before any executive branch agency can start rulemaking, it must be given the authority by the legislature. Legislators can participate in the process like other members, and recently we had a number do that in a DNR rulemaking, which added to the effort. Legislators can review it through the LCC and other various statutes, where if the agency has gone beyond the statutory authority, they can be reined in. Legislators can put a hold on rules during the process by votes of both legislative bodies or committees that have jurisdiction over that subject area. And finally, legislators can pass a bill repealing or stopping the rulemaking in its entirety. These are a number of different pieces of, it is a number of tools that the legislature has and various parts of the rulemaking process to be a part of the process, to help shape it, but also provide oversight. In addition, the Office of Administrative Hearing provides a number of checks and balances and fulfills a key judicial review during the process. Example, they make sure agencies provide appropriate notice to potentially affected individuals, make sure the agencies have the authority and they are staying within that authority given by the legislature, and establishes a need and reasonableness of any rulemaking. And this is important. Minnesota already has a complex and process-heavy rulemaking procedure. It already has more oversight in rulemaking in Minnesota than other states in the federal government. And the comparison is to the federal model, where it's a notice and comments, and then the standard that executive branch agencies are held to is arbitrary and capricious, compared to that standard of need and reasonableness, or what we often refer to as the statement of need and reasonableness that is reviewed by the Office of Administrative Hearings. So that brings me to the high-level concerns that the executive branch agencies have with the legislation. First, under this bill, economic impact trumps all other concerns, consumer protection, human health, privacy issues when looking at a proposed rule. It equates any proposed rule that carries a cost of more than a minimum of $1 per Minnesotan as bad and puts a stop to it unless both bodies of the legislature can come around to agreement on it. When looking at this economic impact, it only looks at it in one small snapshot. It doesn't consider whether one sector may have a cost and those be offset by greater direct economic savings in another sector. For instance, regulations on financial institutions to protect consumer fraud. It doesn't consider short-term costs versus long-term gains. For instance, rulemaking on hunting and fishing versus the protecting the health and viability of fish and game populations. It doesn't factor in benefits that could be included. It only looks at one side of the ledger, not the other social and other types of benefit and a cost-benefit analysis. For instance, drinking water or food safety provisions that the Department of Ag or Health may be looking at for healthier families. And finally, it depends on both bodies of the legislature having time to approve the rules. Again, the reason the executive branch agencies have been given rulemaking is because of the legislature not having the time to commit the in-depth piece to fill in the blanks of the policy that they set on a higher level. A number of times, good bills are not passed by the legislature because of a lack of time. And also it depends on different bodies agreeing on it. For instance, there may be one body that's okay with the bill and the other not because they believe it's too stringent, but it's not stringent enough, which prevents regulation that may need to be passed to meet federal or other types of mandates. We have a concern about the duplicative and redundant process that's created here. We already talked a little bit about the Office of Administrative Hearings and their role as a judicial review. This creates a dual process that has many of the same functions with the Office of Legislative Auditor. Some of those include holding public hearings, taking testimony from interested parties, which the Office of Administrative Hearings already fulfills, determines whether the rule is needed and reasonable. The OLA would do this when the OAH already does this provision. There are already laws preventing agencies from enforcing guidance, policy, bulletins, or others as rules, and there's a remedy through the Office of Administrative Hearings in 14.381. And this is a process that is very rigorous. The Office of Administrative Hearings has numerous times decided at points where the agency has by accident or strayed from the need and ruled against the agency. This is not something that's just where the Office of Administrative Hearings rolls over for the agencies, but in fact does a very critical look at it for the information.
Mr. Kadelka, I heard a finally in there somewhere. We do have two other bills that we need to get to.
Madam Chair, in committee, I just have a couple more points on this important piece of legislation, and I'll wrap it up real quick here.
If you could, and I also encourage you to submit your testimony. It looks like you're reading from it, so you can always submit that to the committee as well. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kadelka.
We've talked a little bit, too, about whether or not a provision is more restrictive than federal regulation and what needs to be provided in the statement of need and reasonableness already. There's already those requirements in the current rulemaking. It does alter the Constitution's separation of powers by giving the legislature the ability to veto rules and raise constitutional separation of powers issues. Both Governor Puente and Dayton have vetoed bills on the legislative approval rules in the past. It also tips the balance in favor of those who might challenge a rule. For instance, parties who may benefit from the rule or have requested the rule. The provision allows for automatic hold, limits requests and timeliness of the problems, and also creates a disadvantage for the public who may want the benefits as a result of the rules. Also, there's an odd addition of environmental review policy that is then placed in the Administrative Procedure Act, which doesn't fit with the overall message within or requirements in the Administrative Procedure Act. So in closing, the agencies are focused on increased efficiency and carrying out our duties, and this actual bill goes in the opposite direction by creating duplicative requirements and unnecessarily increasing cost and time while adding little value. In some cases, actually preventing important public safety, health protections, and worker and financial safeguards from being put into place. We believe a more effective approach is to work on a specific rules or proposed rules where there are concerns and start early in the process through those conversations. Then later after the fact, after a number of time has been invested by various stakeholders through the process. Thank you for the opportunity for sharing our thoughts.
Thank you. Mr. Ring. And we do have a limited amount of time. We have two other bills that we need to get to, so if you can keep your comments concise, and we're happy to have you submit any written testimony that we will distribute to the rest of the committee as well. Mr. Ring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Steve Ring, and I'm here as a volunteer on behalf of the Sierra Club North Star chapter. Within the chapter, I chair the Waters and Wetlands Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to briefly share some of our concerns about House File 1433. State agencies such as the Pollution Control Agency are responsible for protecting the health of our water, air, and communities. When agencies sign off on a decision, whether it's a rule, standard, or issuance of a permit, the public assumes that a fair and well-considered decision is being made in the best interests of the environment. House File 1433 creates new mechanisms for the legislature to delay or block new environment rules from being implemented. Environmental rules and regulations are based on science, and our public agencies are the best equipped to review and interpret scientific data and consensus and apply it to the public interest without bias. The legislature itself recognized this in establishing a process for agency rulemaking in the first place. In the section of the bill that defines substantial economic impact, there's no discussion of benefit analysis. In fact, there are actual economic benefits that clean and healthy environments provide. and dirty environments can have actual economic costs. Environmental regulations and rules are promulgated to prevent degradation or improve the quality of water, land, and air, and ultimately the health and well-being of our communities. Over the long term, the benefits of maintaining a clean environment are high, and it is certainly easier than cleaning up the pollution afterwards. Also, a note about the federal context. Many of our environmental rules and standards are closely interwoven with long-established federal laws, such as the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. Making significant changes to our state rulemaking process now, at the start of a new administration and with unprecedented levels of uncertainty about where our federal agencies are heading, will be premature at best and irresponsible at worst. Nothing is ever perfect, and we are open to a conversation about how to improve transparency, efficiency, and effectiveness of the rulemaking process as it relates to our environmental agencies. But any such changes should be done cautiously, with meaningful involvement from all stakeholders, and with a clear focus on outcomes that Minnesotans care deeply about: clean air, clean water, and a safe and healthy environment. This bill will needlessly block and delay environmental regulation and basically make government less efficient and effective at fulfilling its responsibilities to its citizens. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address your committee with our concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Ring. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify to this bill? All right. Any questions for the three testifiers that we've had so far? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Creasy, I haven't heard much in support of the bill. What happened to the bill last biennium? Can you remind me? You said it was here in 2015-16?
Representative
Creasy. What was its outcome?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we got the bill through and into conference committee, and we were very close, but couldn't get a final agreement between the two bodies, and almost got there. So we're back here trying to shore it up.
Representative Johnson.
I think, Madam Chair, have you spoken to the governor's office as to where they're at with this particular legislation?
Representative Creasy.
I have not spoken to the governor's office directly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the concerns I have with the bill are the ones that were raised, less public transparency and citizen involvement. I mean, that's one of the big issues that we hear at the Capitol, that we want more of transparency and public involvement. It sounds like this is going to essentially result in less. And then the primacy of the economic factor, I think, is a huge problem with the bill at the expense of human health and environmental considerations. Now, I know, Representative Creasy, you do a good job of working with disparate factors, factions, and finding middle ground on issues. Is that your intent with this legislation, too? Are you going to work with the folks that testified to see if we can get somewhere?
Representative Creasy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. I think one of the things this bill does not do, if you go through it, this does not attack any sort of rules. It doesn't go after environment one way or the other. I mean, there's a lot of concerns that are brought up. All this bill simply does is we come down here as legislators, we knock on doors, and we hear things that are happening. And I always hear, and I would be willing to bet most of you have heard in your districts, this rule happened, and how do we roll it back? All this bill does is puts a pause button. It allows us to have some accountability. This is the Get It Right bill. When it leaves, we make sure that if there's an economic impact, that we get one more set of eyes of peers on that before we send it out. Is it going to slow the process up? Yes, it is. And when you get to issues like environment, we should get it right and not just roll it out the door without having that extra layer of making sure it's right.
I think, Madam Chair, well, just a comment. It sounded like it was doing the opposite in terms of public transparency and citizen involvement. And I won't ask the testifiers for questions, but like you requested, Madam Chair, I hope we all get copies of their testimony. Thank you.
Yes, I would encourage all three of you to provide that. You know, Representative Creasy, when I look at this, you probably have experienced this. I know I certainly have, where a rule has been passed, constituents reach out to us and say, how could you do this? And they always assume it's the legislature that passes these rules. Do you think it's more likely that somebody knows who their legislator is or who the commissioner is of agency X, Y, and Z?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a great point. Absolutely, they know us. And we're accountable. And that's really what I'm asking for, is more accountability, right? We go back to our districts, and we have to be able to defend the laws that we put out there. But if we put a law out and that intent changes, and I'm not saying the agencies are doing anything wrong. In fact, I'm trying to help them. Let's give them one more level with the peer group to say, let's get this right so we can all go out and defend the actions that come out of St. Paul. Because at the end of the day, we're knocking on those doors, and we're accountable to our friends and neighbors.
And Representative Kreischer, any other closing comments at all?
I'm going to call this the doing our job, get it right bill, Madam Chair.
All right. Members, this was just before us as an informational. Appreciate that, Representative Kreischer. But you have another bill before us. That's House File 1558.
I do.
I'm going to move the House File 1558. And Representative Kreischer, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an amendment I'd like to offer at this time.
Representative Kreischer, I'll offer the A2 amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment to get it in the shape that the author desires?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, you want to speak to this, don't you?
I do.
Let's talk about this one.
Okay. So, Representative Johnson, you're absolutely right. I try to find compromise. I try to get people to come together. It takes a long time to do that. What I'm doing, the bill that you have in front of me is the Health Insurance Transparency Act. And what it says is it's how the health insurance process is selected in school districts with bargaining units and the collective bargaining process. Right now, under the current situation, there are some school districts, primarily in rural Minnesota, many that I represent, that are required and mandated to get a public employee PEEP bid, which could be great. Maybe I have nothing that says that PEEP is a bad place, but we're mandating that. However, other districts, self-insured districts, are carved out. They don't need to get a PEEP bid unless they want one. And so what I'm doing is saying, okay, let's make this fair. Self-insured districts, if PEEP is great, you get one too, and we will as well. And with that, let's see how the conversation goes.
Is there anybody that wishes to testify on the A2 amendment or the bill itself? And if we could address the A2 amendment first, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent. I assume you're here to speak to the A2 amendment.
Deputy Chairperson Anderson, committee members, thank you for the opportunity before you today. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the Human Resource Director for the Rosemont Appalachian Eagan School District. We have over 28,000 students and provide a self-funded health insurance plan for 2,800 employees. We began self-funding our health insurance plan on July 1st, 2012. Since this time, we've built over a $13 million reserve while averaging just over 1% increase in each of the past 5 years. I have a few concerns regarding the amendment before you. I'll briefly highlight those concerns for you. Currently, when a self-insured school district requests proposals, they request third-party administrator services only to process claims. This amendment would also require self-funded school districts to request proposals for a fully insured plan, as that is all PEEP can offer. This amendment would also this creates an additional expense for the school district and unnecessarily causes insurance carriers to respond to multiple proposals from every self-funded school district, which is a waste of everybody's time. In addition, it does not make sense to request both a self-insured proposal and a fully insured proposal. They're not comparable. Fully insured proposals include significant expenses to cover risks for claims that may not occur. These additional expenses stay with the carrier then. In a self-insured model, we have a reserve that's built for those claims. And if they don't incur, that reserve stays with the school district in that reserve for health insurance. Second concern I have is the HIDTA statute current requirement of requesting proposals every 2 years has already impacted the marketplace. This year, we had one carrier decline to bid on our plan. This has never happened before. I believe that running multiple RFPs will further deter carriers from responding to our proposals. Since yesterday, I've personally spoken to or received emails from 16 self-funded school districts. All of them oppose this amendment. They include Anoka, Burnsville, Cambridge-Isani, Eastern Carver County, Elk River, Farmington, Forest Lake, Minnetonka, Moorhead, Northfield, North St. Paul, South Washington County, Stillwater, Wayzata, White Bear Lake, and Wilmer. Thank you for your time today, and please do not support this amendment.
And Mr. Peterstone, I remember when the HIDTA law was first being debated at the legislature, it included the self-funded schools as part of that, and then you were exempted. I am assuming that you would support not having this apply to any school district. Is that correct?
To any self-funded school district?
Or? No, all school districts.
Yes, I would support that.
Okay, great. Any, we're going to take more testimony, and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testimony, or testifier, can you explain to me what this amendment does to the bill? I don't sit on the Education Committee, so what exactly, does it make the bill worse? By how?
Mr. Peterstone, and is it Peterstone?
Peterstone.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, what this bill would do to us is it takes away our opportunity just to request third-party administrative services. It requires us to request proposals for a fully insured plan, which we don't have right now. We have a self-insured plan, which we only request proposals under current legislation for third-party administrative services to process our claims. We'd have to ask for a completely different proposal to fully insure us again, which has a lot of risk expenses that the carrier would want to put in.
Representative Krishna, you wanted to add to that?
Just very quickly, to your point, Representative Johnson, and you're right on where I'm at. His point is, all this amendment does is takes what's exactly going on in my districts now, which is not beneficial, and would apply it to the self-insured. So the question is, if a self-insured is arguing that this is not good, and all I'm doing is taking what we're exactly doing now, doesn't that lead us back to the fact that maybe the insurance benefits that are carved out and mandated on my small schools should be in parity with the rest of the state? It's either good for everybody or it's good for nobody. Which would you like it?
Okay, I was trying to
figure it out. Thank you, Mr. Peterstone. I've got Scott Nelson. And then after Scott Nelson, Deb Cohen, Aaron Jansen, and Dave Fazio, if you can come to the front. Mr. Nelson, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. You did not see my school district on that list because we were a self-insured school district until our largest employee group of the district voted to go to the PEAT process, which then ended up putting us in a place where we had to liquidate our self-insured program, which is very, very much in a good position to decrease or to have no increase in the fourth year of our insurance plan to zero, and made quite a mess because I had to deal with the cleaning up of a self-insured plan that had to be liquidated, as well as closing a clinic that was open to the employees of the district due to the fact that we were self-insured, and we were able to lower costs of claims by a considerable amount of money to hold down the claims. And just like was said before, the issue is that as a self-insured program, and I've been in over my term, I'm actually the director of business services. I think it says I'm a human resource director, but I've been in 8 public schools, 1 intermediate, and 1 charter school. I've worked in this business for 36 years, and I'm retiring as of April 1 because of this very reason. Not really, but... But to give you an idea of what happened in St. Francis, it was a horrible thing, in my opinion, because the self-insured plan was becoming very, very a vital process of keeping costs down. And we were able to keep the premiums at our level rather than somebody dictating what the levels of the premiums needed to be. That's where this law, I am totally against it, to have anybody have the ability as a employee group, largest employee group of the district, which could be a very small group of people in a way, to dictate what the plan's going to be for the school district. I don't think you'll ever see that in business. I can't believe you'll see that in the private sector. It just blows my mind. What happened to us, we had 2 straight years where we reduced the premiums from over 20% to 2 years later to 9.6. That's quite a drastic change. They were getting anywhere, if I recall right, 7 or 8 years ago, they had a premium that went up 27%. Right now, we have bids in that right now, one of the Medica bid our bids in February and put the whole group into the plan, including the people in the PEAT group, and the plan premium increase is 56%. How can you possibly have a bill, have a law, that allows a user group any type of employee group to dictate what the insurance plan should be for any business. We're a huge business, and you're allowing an employee group to dictate what the plan should be for the whole group. We have 850 employees, 600 of them on the insurance plan. When they did this, 39 people, because we have seven groups here in Ed, Minnesota, when they did this and they voted for it, we had 39 people that were in the lurch, 39 employees. We scrambled to find them an insurance plan. We finally found a small group of our current insurance provider, and we were lucky because they were the only ones that would give us a quote, the only ones. And there's a lot of insurance programs out there, and they were the only ones that would give us a quote for those people. To give you an idea of what happened, in the third year, we were predicting it being well enough. In the fourth year, we were proposing a no increase to our premiums. Yet, we were in the process of doing all of our open enrollment. We were on the last day of open enrollment, and the word came that they were voting on PEEP, and they voted on PEEP. We did all that work from February, where we had the bids in. The insurance committee, which includes the people that I'm very talking about, employees of the district, we have every employee group in the district that's on that committee. And they voted to what the premiums were going to be. In May, the same group of people that sit on that committee voted for PEEP, and our self-insured program is out the door. I don't understand it. Like I said, the open enrollment process was done. It happened at that time. Your administrator that's running this thing is out there telling people that their rate is only going to go up 2%. That's the average. That's what they take into their heads when they go to vote. They go out there and think that. I met with the union president of Edmin, and I said, sorry, I've been on on boards of two insurance programs in my career. And I know how the pool process works. You got these people here, you got these people here, and there's an average. Okay? Well, guess what? If you've got claims rates against your premiums that are up here, you're not going to get a 2% increase. And I told him, if I was a betting man, I had $1 million to bet today, your premium is going to go up no less than 10 to 12%. Guess what? 9.6 and 12.2. The problem was, is they weren't happy with that, so they complained. When they complained, they got a more favorable premium. How can they do that? There's only two ways that premium can possibly change. That's all the other people had to take an increase, or somebody had to eat it. PEEP is run by the state of Minnesota, taxpayer money. Okay? The company administers it and the MMB make a decision that they were able to reduce that premium. Where'd that money come from? Who paid for it? I know who paid for it. I did. You did. Because somewhere along the line, that money's got to be covered. Well, again, we closed the clinic. The timeline for the vote, that's the other thing. They voted in May. We had our rates and everything done in February. We had the insurance plan already in place. They voted in May, and we ended up doing all that work over again. So, in my opinion, I think the whole law should go away. I think this amendment would not be helpful. And where does this fall in collective bargaining? They've got the power. Doesn't help us at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. I've got Ms. Cody, Deb Cody. Aaron Jansen is next. Please come to the front. And Dave Fazio, if you could please come to the front. Ms. Cody.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Deb Cody. I'm an ESP from Caledonia. I work for the Caledonia School District for 34 years, and I work so that my husband and I can have insurance. My take-home pay is $13.66 a month. Providing we don't have a two-hour late start snow day, and then I bring home 45 cents. Our ESP bargaining unit chose to go with PEEP because of the constant rate increases of anywhere from 20 to 40%. But on years we requested PEEP bids, our rates were lower, which I believe is due to getting these bids. After numerous increases in insurance rates, our bargaining unit decided to seriously look into PEEP. We held numerous informational meetings, brought in outside resources to provide information about PEEP, like other school districts and our county workers at our Houston County Courthouse, who had PEEP. Only after exhaustive research and communication with our members did we decide to vote overwhelmingly for PEEP. For years, the ESP, or 2 years after the ESP group joined PEEP, the teachers, along with all other district employees who were faced with another 25% increase in rates, joined PEEP as well. I appreciate all that you are doing, and we need to find the most efficient cost ways to purchase health insurance for us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Cody. Mr. Jansen. Welcome to the committee. Can you please state your name for the record and who you represent?
My name is Aaron Jansen. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I come here from Fillmore Central School District. It's just south of Rochester. And what my wife and I both teach, and one of the things that we faced is just raising of our insurance costs year after year after year. And so since HIDA, what it has done is created transparency. Every year, our district has to, or every 2 years, our district has to get bids from both PEEP and from our co-op. And it has to be opened. Both bids have to be opened at the same time. All I'm asking for you to do is consider the fact that it's creating competition and transparency at a district level. And it has lowered the cost of insurance for people like me, and it's a big deal. So we kind of stand at a crossroads here, more transparency or less transparency. And in this case, it creates more transparency at a district level. It creates competition. And if you look at the national level right now, looking at health insurance, we know that competition is the number one word that gets used when it comes to health insurance. And that's all I'm asking, for you to consider that competition has been a good thing and will continue to be a good thing. And our district has not gone with PEEP, but the competition has lowered the cost of our insurance, and that is a big deal. So competition is the name of the game, and the more competition, the better. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Fazio. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Fazio. I'm a teacher at Northwood School, St. Louis County. Now, I've negotiated contracts for a long time teaching, and we had a shared vision of the rising cost of insurance in our district. And I hit a crossroads with a continual double digit, even to the 20% increases that we were seeing. We met in the summer. Business manager, superintendent, myself, and another representative, and we agreed to look at all things, including PEEP. Next round of bargaining comes up, and we're moving through that, and that was a huge topic during those rounds, the insurance costs, and all of a sudden PEEP was no longer a decision. We've been in PEEP in our school district, and we did come from a school district that was not self-insured, so a small blip of high usage jacked rates up high. So, finishing story there, the PEEP was off the table, and we were just trying to get our hands wrapped around it. Well, with our choice, which is huge, to go to PEEP, our membership did choose that. We've been in it about 4 or 5 years. Our rates have really stabilized. We haven't seen those 20% rate increases. The rest of the negotiating parties in our district and personnel staff there stayed with the co-op. Well, this last round, our insurance through PEEP and the teachers went up 3%. The insurance increase for the district through the co-op, 20-plus percent, 25-ish. They bailed and went to another place. But I just want to emphasize that PEEP was open-armed to bring them in at the teacher rates and also save money. And right now, currently, the teachers and the district are saving money through PEEP.
Great. Thank you. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I'm Mary Ann Thomas, the Director of Human Resources for the Farmington Area School District. I've been there 5.5 years and worked at two other school districts for an additional 18 years. In Farmington, we have about 7,000 students. We cover about 600 employees on our health insurance, and about 1,000 belly buttons are covered. After much research, education, our insurance committee, which is represented by all employees of the school district, went to a self-insured plan on July 1st, 2013. It's been very successfully managed by our employee groups through this insurance committee, and we've managed to build $1.5 million of reserve towards our health insurance, which would always be there to pay our claims and other expenses. With regard to this bill, I'd just like to make three quick comments, or this amendment on this bill. To require self-funded insurance, school districts with self-funded insurance seems to be a waste of time and, more importantly, money for our taxpayers. It requires us to get fully insured bids, which we've already made the decision 3.5 years ago. We don't want to have a fully insured plan. We want to have a self-insured plan where we have more control over what the plan looks like, those expenses, and we quit giving more money to the insurance companies. If we were to choose to get a fully insured bid, we have the right to do that. We don't need an amendment to do that. We could do that today. Secondly, if this amendment does expand the number of years you are required to go out for a bid from 2 to 3 to 4, we would be supportive of that. To require it at 2 years is very short time frame in the world of health insurance. The one portion of this amendment that I do support, and most of my colleagues do support, is taking away the ability of one employee group, the largest employee group in the school district in our case, to decide to go to PEEP and leave everybody else in the lurch, as St. Francis business director talked about earlier today. When you take over half of your members, if the teacher group were to go to PEEP, take half your members and leave close to 30 or 40% of the members that have to either scramble for a plan or they are forced to go into PEEP, makes no sense at all. It makes more sense if all the employees have a say in what the health insurance plan looks like, and they currently do through our insurance committee, which is represented by all employees in the school district. I thank you for your time and consideration and listening to my non-support of this total amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Members, Representative Krusha, you want any comments?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
So I think I can move this along pretty quickly. Members, I'll withdraw my amendment, which will take the pressure off the self-insured districts. And now here's the decision you're left with. Those burdens are on my district now. If you support my bill, as I've taken the pressure off the self-insured, if you support my bill, we'll be on equal playing field with the self-insured. I would like you to give me parity in the market, so I just don't go back to the rural school districts and say, once again, you are being put with burdens that we let off of other school districts. With that, I think, is our motion?
I have to move it.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to do that. As
you
know, I have a self-insured school district and was deeply opposed to your amendment. with that, members, any questions at all? All right, I'm going to renew my motion then, unless you have any other final comments, Representative Krusha, are we good?
I think the point has been made, Madam Chair.
Great. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1558 be referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Krusha. Members, we are going to do Representative Howe. He's been very patient. This is what happens when you leave us.
I just so enjoy this committee, Madam Chair.
I know it.
Madam Chair, so.
Welcome back. Representative
Absolutely.
Howe, we've got, I'm going to move House File 136 to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And after seeing the last fiscal note that was 21 pages long, I decided to make some modifications so I could get a fiscal note that was 23 pages long. Madam Chair, I'd like to move the DE2 amendment.
Okay, I'm going to move the DE2 amendment. Representative Howe to the DE2 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. The original bill moved all the agencies to a zero-based budget at one time, and we got a rather large fiscal note on it. So I decided to ease the pain as we went into this and take each group of agencies at a, and ease this into over time. So we take each biennium, we take so many of them and move them into a zero-based budget, and that's what the DE2 amendment does. After reading the current revised fiscal note, I realized that in the DE2 there is a missing component, which I would hope that if this is moved forward, that either at the next stop or if it's being held over for inclusion.
Laid over, yeah.
If it's being laid over for inclusion, the piece that wasn't in there is as these agencies go to a zero-based budget, the requirement to do a base budget would be removed and they'd be exempted from the state statute that requires them to do so. That would minimize the, that would change the fiscal note again, because there would be some folks that wouldn't be required to do so. So if
I think Mr. Howe, or Representative Howe, if Ms. Roberts can weigh in.
Absolutely.
A little bit. Thank you. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, members, I just want to clarify the fiscal note that was in your packet is on the bill as was introduced. We received the amendment last night, and I have put a request in for a revised fiscal note. So the fiscal note you're looking at is not for the amendment. And I think just in general, if you look at it on the first page, the amendment no longer applies to the legislature and the retirement system. So those costs would drop off. And then I think you can see that the majority of the costs are for Minnesota management and budget, and that there would likely be some changes to those numbers based on the amendment because of your phasing in the different agencies.
And Ms. Roberts and Mr. Gearing, I assume then, too, when I'm looking at the House research summary, too, that says as introduced, so that would be off as well. So if you can help us a little bit, maybe get through what does your DE2 amendment do?
The DE2 amendment, if you look at this on it's basically the big changes are start on line 2.15, and what it does is start at 2018, and you can see the agencies listed. Those would be the ones that would transfer and do a zero-based budget. And then as you start on line 2.21, I should put my glasses on, that would be in fiscal year, biennium 2020, those would be the agencies that would transfer and start doing a zero-based budget. And then in 2022, those would be on line 2.27, and that's just how it goes. So each there's a group of agencies that would start doing zero-based budgeting.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
I guess that's the biggest changes as it goes forward. And then if you see, I think on line 3.3, that's the last iteration of folks that would transition to a zero-based budget proposal.
Okay. All right. Any other thoughts that you want to offer on it at all, or?
No, I think that this actually gives a transition period, so we're not hit all at one time in doing this. I would guess, I will ask the question, if you would allow me, Madam Chair, to anyone that actually has gone through this process from a base budget process to a zero-based budget process to raise their hand. Well, there's two of us. And I will tell you that it's a painful process. I did this myself. But I will tell you, the stuff that I found that was buried in my budget when I went through it was astonishing. Now, it wasn't an easy process, but it was a highly effective process. And there was at one time when we were thinking about just doing this. In fact, the Senate amendment that I took and changed to make this DE2 amendment actually had us doing it once and then 10 years, then going back to a base budget process and then going doing a zero-based budget every 10 years. I will tell you that having gone through this pain, you don't want to do it every 10 years
because it's easy to do it every year thereafter, because you know your budget better than anything else when you do a zero-based budget, because you know line by line exactly where you're spending every dollar and why you're spending those dollars. And if you don't spend those dollars there, you know what's going to happen. So having gone through the pain and having gone through the process, I wouldn't do it any other way, because it's easy to maintain once you've done it, because you know it, and you know what's in there, and you know every time you increase something, you know what's in there. So that's why I'm a big proponent of zero-based budgeting. And with that, I would, if we can pass the DE2 amendment, Madam Chair, and then get the bill in the form I would prefer.
We will do that. To get the bill in the form that the author prefers, members, we're going to vote on the DE2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Members, Representative Johnson, you want to ask a question now, or do you want to hear Ms. Kelly first? What would you prefer?
Ms. Kelly, thank you.
All right. Ms. Kelly? Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Margaret Kelly, Assistant Commissioner and State Budget Director at Minnesota Management and Budget, and thank you for the opportunity today to come and talk about this bill. I appreciate the DE2 amendment. We will take a look at it more closely and see how we would adjust our fiscal note based on it. I do want to point out on line 3.3, it requires a select group of agencies to do zero-based budgeting beginning in 2026 and every year thereafter. So I'm not sure if that was your intent, Representative. But let me just speak more broadly first, that I'd like to confirm my commitment as a budget director to the budget process and to the information that's provided in the document. We have a broad set of activities that we're responsible for in the budget division, and preparing the governor's budget is one of our responsibilities. And while it's the governor's budget recommendations that we prepare, we publish the document for your use as well. And so our goal is to effectively communicate the budget and the changes to it. And to do that, we consult every other year with House and Senate leadership, along with chairs of Ways and Means and Senate Finance, to seek your advice in the form and format of the document. So we welcome your input. We work closely with House and Senate fiscal staff and make what adjustments we can to the document to meet their needs as well. And so I'd also want to just remind you briefly that what you currently have in a budget document and the process that we go through to produce it. Our document is 3,000 pages long, give or take a page. It includes background narratives on activities, goals, and performance measures already for each agency. The fiscal pages provide budget information for each activity for prior years and the next two biennia. And we also highlight changes the governor is recommending. The process is an 8-month process from start to finish, working with agencies to get this done, to complete the narrative, the background information, and the base budget information that's delivered to you on November 30th, and the budget recommendations delivered in January with the governor's budget. I have a couple concerns about the bill, and that it will require additional budget processes to be completed on top of what we are currently doing. Zero-based budgeting is a concept that's been around since the early 70s. The federal government has experimented with it in modified forms, and to date, no state has used zero-based budgeting for an extended period of time. This bill requires us to do zero-based budgeting in the original form, where you start from a zero budget, and in modified forms as well, where you look at current service level funding, minimal service level funding, and ranking of activities, outcome measures as well. States that have used zero-based budgeting approaches have abandoned them. It proved to be cumbersome, time-intensive, and expensive a process that did not yield the intended outcomes. The National Conference of State Legislators, your professional organization, in a review of zero-based budgeting, summarized the elements as being impossible to assimilate into the state budget process, and its techniques were impractical for allocating resources, and federal efforts have not been successful as well. I think there's a difference between, as a manager, using a zero-based budgeting approach to make decisions about how you will allocate resources in your budget. There's a difference between that and providing a legislator or decision-making body a zero-based budget document. I think that's where the effort becomes cumbersome. So I agree with the National Conference of State Legislators when they recommend that we should be clear about why what we want when we're considering zero-based budgeting. Are we trying to analyze all of state government spending at once? Are we responding to a fiscal crisis? Are we wanting a deep dive in selected areas of state spending? Or is it something else we're looking for? I think this bill would be improved by greater clarity. Our fiscal note would also be improved by greater clarity and definition and specificity of what you're looking for in zero-based budgeting. What do you mean by an activity? We currently provide budgeting information at budget information and activity level. What do you mean by program outcomes? We currently provide program outcomes in the budget document. And what do you mean by an itemized account of expenditures? Again, we provide budget information at an expenditure level. If you're looking for something different than what we currently provide, I welcome that opportunity to talk with you about how we could change it. Our fiscal note for this bill was based on conversations with other states that had experimented with zero-based budgeting. And one state in particular, Georgia, that does 10% of their budget on an annual basis, recommended that we increase our staffing by 100%. Another state that did their entire budget in a modified zero-based budget strategy for one biennium recommended we increase our staffing by 30%. And both states recommended that we increase staffing in state agencies that will have to produce the zero-based budget as well. We took an approach of a 50% increase in our staff at MNB and increase in the complement within state agencies. This bill, while it parses out the budgets that would be subject to zero-based budgeting in the first biennium, it still requires over 75% of the budget to be subject to a zero-based budget approach based on the agencies that are selected for review. So if the intent is to reduce the fiscal note, we would have to talk about other strategies besides just that. But I welcome any questions, and I'm available later.
Representative, how do you want to comment, first of all, or do you want to wait?
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I think that I'm not denying that this isn't a cumbersome process, but there's nowhere in there discussing about after you get done with this, it's a very simple process to continue. And I understand that some of them have tried it once and abandoned it, but I think that once you've done this, and once you've gone through this, you have a basis and an understanding that will make budgeting simpler, and you find stuff in that budget that, as far as when I did it in my budget, I found things that we hadn't done or purchased in years, but they were still a line item, they were there, and until I did a line-by-line zero-based budget and took it from nothing and built the budget, I had no clue that it had been buried there decades before I took over. So that's nowhere in this fiscal note, and I don't think you're going to get there because we don't know how much we're going to save by going through the process in later years. I understand it's going to be painful to get there, but once we get there, and I don't have my testifier here. He couldn't make it today, but I say I have gone through the process, I've seen the benefits, and I do believe that the cost is worth the pain.
Representative Johnson?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Kelly, are there any states that are using this approach now?
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, Representative, the only state that is currently using any form of zero-based budgeting is the state of Georgia, where they, as a budget office, work with the legislature to identify what areas of state government they would like a deep dive done into. And it's not an entire budget. It is an activity within a budget. So, for example, it would not be all of MNB, but it might be the budget division at MNB. It would not be all of Human Services, but perhaps Adult Mental Health at Human Services. The deep dive that they do is simply providing greater detail than they currently provide in their biennial budget on that activity. So they provide additional information about the level, about what type of spending occurs and for what purposes. And they do not actually build a budget from zero up. They do not actually provide a minimum level service budget, nor do they provide a current service level budget. They just provide a greater breadth and depth of information than they provide in the rest of their budget document. In looking at what they provide, it's not that different from what we currently provide in our budget document. We provide more information in our budget document than most states do.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. And then to Representative Howe, I think you probably did have, well, I'm sure you did have good luck with the way you addressed it in your business, because I have no doubt about that. My only additional thought is that if we went this route, I hope you would fight for the resources necessary to implement it, you know, because I'm afraid if we get a low target here for this particular committee, you know, we're not just going to have any money for it.
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair, and you know, as Ms. Kelly says that they're doing a deep dive, that almost sounds like more of an audit than a budget, but to your response, it wasn't my business where I did this. I did it for the city of St. Cloud as a fire marshal. So I was doing the fire marshal division's budget, and that's where it was the first time. So it was local government where I was doing this and had the city. We had great, great success, and I believe they're still doing it today.
Representative Ugo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, you mentioned that other states have had these huge staffing increases and you budgeted in the fiscal note for that. But given, and Representative Howell has testified to this, given the fact that once you get through, and I agree, this is a massive total sea change that we're asking for, or Representative Howell is asking for. But once you get through that, after a couple of years, what are the staffing levels supposed to do? Are they supposed to trend downwards?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, the state of Oregon, one state that we spoke with, only did it for one cycle and then abandoned it. The governor came in and said, we're going to do this, and did not continue doing it. It didn't produce the results he was hoping for. So they did not maintain. Second, in the other state we talked to, Georgia, which I described earlier, are currently, they're on a 10-year plan. So they are reviewing, doing a deep dive on 10% of their budget every year. And so they don't foresee, they're in, I think, year three or four, and would not foresee any changes in staffing because of the intensity that review requires.
Representative
Ugo. Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, well, I could believe that because this is something that could take a generation to get done through state government and everything else. You refer to the deep dive idea or concept here. And I'm assuming then when you're talking about that, you're looking at increased detail, increased accuracy, when they're singling out these couple of departments to begin with in terms of the budgeting process.
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm speaking about increased detail. I would hope that the accuracy would be the same as we currently provide, but pretty much just increased detail in the level of information. So currently we may provide information about adult mental health more broadly, but I think this deep dive would look at every single strategy that is used within the adult mental health program and provide budget information at that level, as well as more. We currently have information in our budget system about the types of expenditures, whether it's full-time staff or part-time staff, whether it's contracts or whether it's grants. And it provides that level of detail in Georgia. They currently don't have that level of detail in their overall budget. So,
Madam Chair, Director, yeah, when you talk about that detail and things, and if you look at the fact that you have to direct and manage, obviously, a very, very intense, very, very large budget, and we have to manage that also, zero-based budgeting is really the ideal in many respects. But can it actually work for government? It can work for business, obviously, and it can work for small municipalities and everything else. And I'm sure, Director, that you've probably read books about it and all of that. Is there a middle ground? Is there a modified version of this that would be, in your estimation, feasible?
Ms. Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think it would be helpful to know what it is you're wanting to accomplish, and that we could talk about how to incorporate that and ensure that that's a part of the budget document. I think one thing that you all have tried to do in the last couple of years that you may not recall is with evidence-based budgeting. And you passed a law 2 years ago requiring MMB to implement the Pugh-MacArthur Results First model, which looks at items of expenditure within agency budgets and what the evidence suggests around cost-benefit analysis of that activity and whether or not we should see a return on our investment for that or whether it's costing us more to implement, and allowing you as decision makers to evaluate, are we okay with that? Do we want to give up a strategy we have thought was good, even though it's not, because it's not producing the benefit, and invest in something else? So we have gone down that road for about 2 years now. We have implemented that with regards to adult mental health and with regards to adult correctional services. I think those committees are pleased with what the work we have done. I think that's something we could talk more about if you wanted different information. That's one thing that I think may be helpful more broadly across state government.
Representative,
Madam Chair, and I think ultimately Representative Howe is looking at, you know, obviously these improvements and things, zero-based budgeting being on this end of the paradigm, yours being current here, and what you just explained, moving towards more zero-based budgeting, really, in terms of management analysis and things, and the tools that you give us. So I applaud Representative Howe for moving forward with this. I think it's a great idea, but I think we cannot fool ourselves one little bit that this would be a massive undertaking and would take a long time. And if it ever did work, it would be just absolutely wonderful, but it's very difficult, huge challenges. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the thought dawns on me today as I hear Representative Howe and Director Kelly and the conversation with members, that as we look at this, the only way that I can put this into a context that I can relate to is the state budget is like a chest of drawers when I was growing up as a kid. All right, I get T-shirts and I put them in there, and I get socks and I put them in there, and I get all my clothes and I put it in the dresser drawer. Every once in a while, my parents would say, "It's time to clean out the dresser drawer." Well, I don't want it because that's a lot of work. On what's in there? Are you still working with that? Still using that stuff?
Did you miss under the bed?
Well, I haven't got to the closets yet either. So every once in a while, I would come home and there'd be a surprise for me. Everything that was in my dresser, everything that was in my closet, was dumped on my bed. So I'd have to look through it, right? So, Ms. Kelly, when do we ever dump the state budget on the bed and go through it under the current system?
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair, Representative, my son's dresser, when it's dumped on the bed, just simply ends up on the floor. So,
I'm not saying where it went, Director Kelly. I'm just saying that it ended up on the bed originally.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that you could do that at any point you want. The question is, what is the most cost-effective way to do that? And I think that while you may not do that as a body frequently, I think that commissioners and managers across state government who are managing their budgets do that on a regular basis, because they are year after year faced with growing budget challenges that they need to manage to. And the only way to manage to those growing budget challenges is to take a look at what you have and what you're spending your resources on and move them around to meet the needs that you have.
I'm sure just a quick follow-up, and I think I've made my point, but to the idea of, you know, it's the same thing that when my parents would stand there and they'd say, well, why are you keeping that T-shirt? Why are you keeping it? Because it's my favorite. I like it. I don't want to get rid of it. I still think we're having the commissioners have their likes and their favorites on different things. And is it still good public policy? Is it still good fiscal policy? And I respect your answer. I really do. But I still question whether or not the stuff goes back in the drawer and whether it's in the same format that it came out.
Now I have the vision from Friends of Ross in this T-shirt that's too small. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only comment on the previous line of discussion, was it staffing or management that caused it to be on the floor? I would hope that, you know, because the author's testifier and reference isn't present, because it was brought up that Georgia is the one that's still doing this in some form, and I look back at some notes, and apparently it started with a small peanut farmer, became governor, and then president, that if there's some historical data over the decades from growth of budget and different processes that they've got on Georgia, so it sounds like they've done different iterations, that might be useful as background information that we could have, and then also any other data that, you know, they've tried it in certain parts of the federal government and where they've had some success, that additional background data might be useful. So it's a request for additional information, not a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, actually that peanut farmer brought it to the federal government, and NCSL's review of zero-based budgeting was based on those efforts, and I'd be happy to share that with all of you.
I've got Representative Johnson.
After they're done.
All right. I've got a couple of questions. You mentioned Georgia. What was the other state that you
Madam Chair, we spoke with the state of Oregon. There are probably a few other states that have tried it in the recent past in modified forms that we could also reach out to but have not yet.
Okay. And Ms. Kelly, when you talked about Georgia, what I got as an impression after you had conversation with Representative Uglum is that Georgia was kind of starting from ground zero, and that they were building documents that never existed. Is that kind of the assessment? And that's probably why they were recommending a 100% increase in their staffing levels?
Madam Chair, when you say started from ground zero, I'm not sure if you mean that they started from a zero budget, but they did not start from
zero. I mean that they didn't have anything, really.
But Madam Chair, they have a budget document, and what they defined zero-based budgeting as was providing substantially more detail on a segment of the budget every budget period. And so that's what I refer to as the deep dive, is looking under the hood more closely, so to speak, looking in all the drawers and describing what the spending is so that policymakers could make decisions about whether or not they wanted to keep the favorite shirt.
Well, I asked that, Ms. Kelly, because based upon what you've said, it sounds like they didn't have kind of the documents that we have currently. So I think that you were basing your fiscal note off of going from the other state, being Oregon, saying a 30% increase, to Georgia being 100% increase, and you've settled on 50%. And I'm guessing that Georgia is probably more at the 50% level, 30%, and so you'd probably be lower than that. It's just my guess, but I'll look into that more closely. But I do want to ask a favor of you. We've had the Department of Revenue in a couple of times, and we've asked for additional information, and we have not been able to get it. And so I know that you said that you are willing to provide additional information to us. We want that additional information.
Madam Chair, I'm aware of your request. My understanding is the information is forthcoming, and I will check on that.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Howe, closing comments?
Well, Madam Chair, I've got two closing comments, and one is it seems like we're stuck in tradition and we're doing the stuff that's easy, and why do we do it this way? Because we've always done it this way. It's tradition. And my definition of tradition is the reason you do something when you forgot the real reason why you did it. So, and the other comment I'll make, Madam Chair, is I think the pain is worth the gain. I definitely believe this is the right answer. I haven't gone through it myself. And if it does be successful, I'd rather have it called the Banyan Budget Bill.
With that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 136, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government omnibus finance bill. Thank you, Representative Howe. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One is, when do you think we'll see the omnibus bill for this committee? And then secondly, can we count on you to give us sufficient time, our DFL caucus, to review it 2 to 3 days, have a chance to walk through it?
I don't know when we'll see it. When I do, I'll give you a heads up. I'm glad you raised that issue, too. I just want to say a reminder to members, we do have committee tomorrow at 9. I will try to get us out of here. Friday at 9. I'm getting ahead of myself. Shoot. I wish it was Thursday today. But Friday at 9, we will be having a committee hearing, and I just want to make sure you all have that on your calendars. Just have that as part of your thing. But Representative Johnson, as soon as I know things, I'll be able to pass them on to you. So.
The main thing from our perspective is that we just have time to review it.
Sure, you bet.
Yep.
All right, members, with that, we are adjourned.